It's Friday, February 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, peace talks break down as the battle rages on in Syria.
You can be a moderate or you can be a progressive. You can't be a moderate and a progressive.
The campaign rhetoric intensifies in the race for the White House. Also ahead, the real Super Bowl winner may be the fans inside the stadium. And we look at the ladies of the Oscars. It's all on today's International Edition. Special UN envoy Stéphane de Mistura, who pronounced the latest effort at Syrian peace talks officially underway in Geneva Monday, suspended them Wednesday, insisting it will be a temporary pause to last not more than 3 weeks.
From the first day, I've indicated that I'm not prepared to hold talks for the sake of talks, and the Secretary General has said the same. The UN cannot allow simply procedural matters to actually become more important than actually the result for the humanitarian situation of the Syrian people who have been waiting for us to deliver, this time not a conference, but something concrete for them.
He insisted he is not disappointed or frustrated, but determined and realistic. The Saudi-backed opposition delegation, known as the High Negotiations Committee, says it will not return until it sees positive steps on humanitarian issues. Meanwhile, on the battlefield, Russian-backed Syrian ground forces recaptured two villages near the northern city of Aleppo that had been held by rebel hands since 2012. That's a development viewed as a major victory for Assad forces. Middle East Institute scholar Zubir Iqbal told VOA's Victor Beatty that given this latest success, the talks, if they ever reconvene, must be guided by new principles and ground rules.
The Assad government clearly has used a pause that is provided by the impending peace negotiations to strengthen its position in Aleppo. And Russia has helped them in the process. Now, these kinds of things do happen. I mean, it's nothing very unusual. The unusual part that I see is that it happened so brazenly, and the United Nations didn't even know that it was happening. The United Nations basically showed its weakness, its inability to do these kinds of things. And to be a peaceful, unbiased broker is one thing, but to be negligent is something else. Now, another problem exists, and that is the United Nations operation had brought along two broad adversaries who control only one-third of the country. The two-thirds of the country is controlled by other agencies, other forces, which are not even represented in these peace negotiations. So to begin with, these peace negotiations were a pie in the sky. They were not going to work out because they didn't represent the majority of the participants. They represented a small minority, especially one of those minorities that was not interested at all, was only interested in strengthening its position. And it did. Now, from now on, any attempts at negotiation will start from the Assad government and the Russians being on a much stronger foundation than the opposition, which then would mean that it's the ISIS, the Daesh, that will tend to benefit. And if they benefit, the fear that I have is that the moderate elements, which are now considered as the faithful opposition, will leave this faithful opposition and go and join ISIS, which will be very damaging and disastrous.
How likely will the talks resume in 3 weeks?
Not at all. Even if they were to get together, it would be just a face saving, and that's it. Look, there is no foundation. What are they going to get together to negotiate on? Now they're going to require, the opposition is going to require, go back to the old lines that existed before this action in Aleppo, which the Assad government will not be interested to do, and the Russians will not force them to do it. So under those circumstances, what can be the foundation to begin? If the opposition group were to come in to negotiate under changed circumstances, that will show their weakness, and that would mean that many of their own parties will tend to leave, and they'll join the ISIS. This is the time when I think other parties must take on and be more aggressive. It's necessary that the parties that are opposed to the Russian intervention must become much more active.
Zubair Iqbal says with the eventual capture of Aleppo, Syria will have achieved its main objective of regaining control over the country's main economic centers. And after that, he says, it's just a waiting game for the opposition forces to tire and leave or surrender. It's time for us now to check out what the trending stories are on social media platforms. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in the studio for that. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, what do you have for us today?
Let's talk about propaganda balloons across the inter-Korean de facto border. I know it sounds like old news, but trust me, it's different this time because it's from North Korea to the south.
Ah, the winds have shifted, of course. Mm-hmm. Well, we often hear about balloons flying the other direction. So what's Pyongyang's message?
Basically, it's calling South Korea a land of political filth and its leaders, get this, human trash. Mm. That's why it added cigarette butts in the balloons to stress their point.
Wow, interesting insert there. So if I remember correctly, the inter-Korean tensions eased quite drastically with an agreement last August, correct?
That is correct. And it flared up again when the North conducted its nuclear test last month. The fourth nuclear test was on January 6th, and since then, the South resumed its loudspeaker propaganda broadcast along the border, and the contents include, but not limited to, South Korean pop music and criticism of the Kim Jong-un regime.
Okay, I understand the criticism part, but what's with the pop music?
Well, I wondered about that too when I first heard the news, but what's more even interesting is that K-pop turned out to be more effective than criticizing the regime when it comes to dampening the soldiers' morale. So basically, if you counter propaganda with propaganda, that's tit for tat. Mm. But if you can show your target country, it's not like your country where everything is censored and controlled by the state, then you're in a class of your own, and which is very similar to what we try to do here at VOA. We show you America with warts and all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, our mission is delivering fair and unbiased news and information. So what's the South Korean reaction to this?
Well, for that, I went on to Naver News, which is the country's most popular news aggregator. A lot of people are criticizing what they view as Seoul's weak response to North Korea. So the balloons were timed to detonate at a certain time, but the ones that failed to function as programmed crashed onto South Korean rooftops and cars in border cities and damaged them pretty badly. And some were even criticizing that the government should allow North Korean defectors to send propaganda leaflets to the north, which is actually an illegal activity. The activist groups still do that, but they're technically not allowed to. And of course, in English language media, there were plenty of the butt of the joke comments, Jim.
Well, whatever floats North Korea's boat, I guess. And you can follow G. Abby Lee floating around on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. And I'm out there as well at VOA Stevenson. By the way, our program's account is at VOA_IE. We invite you to follow that stream as well. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. The road to the White House continues as voters listen to candidates' appeals ahead of the first state primary, which is in New Hampshire on Tuesday. And while the crowded Republican field begins to thin amid wild campaign jabs between candidates, the choice for Democrats is between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, who, by the way, says he is progressive while trying to say his opponent is not. VOA's Cindy Sain covers Capitol Hill for us and has been listening to this war of words for us.
Yes, that's right. Senator Bernie Sanders unleashed a bit of a Twitter feud recently, saying about his opponent, Hillary Clinton, you can be a moderate or you can be a progressive. You can't be a moderate and a progressive. And this is really, it sounds like semantics, but I think it's more about the soul of the Democratic Party. Hillary Clinton has been around for a long time. She is pushing for incremental change. She basically wants to defend President Obama's record, President Obama's health care reform, and she says that Bernie Sanders wants to throw that all away and go for what he's describing as a political revolution when he talks to young people across college campuses.
And this is born out of a campaign this year that has been highlighted by the outsiders, or the perception of being an outsider. Hillary's in an interesting position because she's been an insider, but she says, no, actually, I'm an outsider. And it has raised this interesting question of, well, what is Hillary?
Yes, that's right. And at a time where there is palpable anger in the country and the feeling that, you know, some people are not doing well and haven't been doing well for some time, she has a bit of, as you say, a bit of a hard case to make, saying, well, actually, things are going well. We just need to keep up the fight. And that seems to be what people don't want to hear. And it was striking in the Iowa caucus that Bernie Sanders won young people by more than 70%. Mm. The margins were just unbelievable. And Hillary Clinton was asked about that, and she says, well, she said, young people may not be for me, but I'm still for them. So she's trying to defend her record. And on the Hill, Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic Minority Leader, waded into the debate and defended all sides and said, yes, of course, Hillary is a progressive. Who gets to define, who gets to set the standard for who is a progressive? And some Democrats are pushing back now against Sanders.
Interesting. Bernie Sanders, of course, is a candidate who has been really railing against the top 1%, if you will, the few people who hold most of the money. And this has resonated well with young voters because, you know, it's tough starting out when you're young and you don't tend to have a lot of money and it's difficult to find a job, et cetera.
That's right. And one of the things that Bernie Sanders is saying, he wants free public education, free public university for young people, and he wants Wall Street to pay for it. And this is something that, of course, which goes very well on college campuses. And he says basically that the system is rigged and that we need to shake things up. And this does appeal, seems to be appealing to young people. And he has a problem, on the other hand, with older voters, although he's 74 years old, which is also interesting.
The one label we like to apply to you is VOA House Correspondent. And thanks so much for telling us a little bit about the semantics on the campaign trail today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
On Sunday, American Style Football celebrates the 50th anniversary of its championship game, the Super Bowl. Fans attending the very first Super Bowl in 1967 likely could not imagine the high-tech experience that's in store for this year in Santa Clara, California. International Business Times media and cultural reporter Max Willens joins us with what's new at the new Levi's Stadium.
Every time an NFL team looks to build a new stadium, they have this mandate to build a stadium that's bigger and shinier and more impressive than the ones that came before it. When the San Francisco 49ers, who built Levi's Stadium, which is where the game will be played, they thought that rather than focus on building more luxury boxes or building bigger, shinier, snazzier video monitors to show instant replay on, they wanted the thing that was going to make their stadium stand out be internet connectivity and cell phone capability. That's exactly what they've done. Levi's Stadium has more Wi-Fi capacity than any other NFL stadium and really any other stadium in the United States. All that extra bandwidth has really made it possible for them to play around with the kinds of experiences that you have while you're at the stadium. Specifically, in this case, we're talking about an app that the people that are attending the game can use. And the app, really, if you're using it to its fullest, really can kind of change the way that people think about attending an NFL game. You can order a drink that will be brought right to your seat. You can order merch that you can pick up on your way out of the stadium. You can watch instant replay after every single play. You can even watch during the stoppages. You can watch the Super Bowl commercials that everyone talks about so much while you're sitting there in your seat.
That's a big deal because I've been to a few Super Bowls, and I'll tell you, I had to videotape them and go back and watch because I had no clue what was going on during the telecast, and I knew everybody was going to be talking about the commercials, of course. I've also been in stadiums where it's very difficult just to make a phone call. This is a big deal.
It's a huge deal. In 2014, when the Super Bowl was held at MetLife Stadium outside of New York City, more than 2.5 terabytes of cellular data passed through the stadium on Super Bowl Sunday. That's a ton of data, obviously, but there are projections that this year at Levi's Stadium, they're talking about a number north of 16 terabytes. It's just an incredible amount of data that they're going to have to provide.
These stadiums really are not used a lot during the year. There's a limited amount of time that they have with all the people in to make the most of those people being there in terms of selling beverages and merchandise and that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. You think of NFL stadiums as being these impressive, potentially very useful, money-generating fixtures in a landscape, but they're actually almost the opposite. I mean, Levi's Stadium, for example, in 2015, it only played host to 20 events, and 10 of those were NFL games. That's 8 regular season and 2 preseason. And it's just very difficult to find use for a building that holds 60, 70, 80, 90,000 people. And because they're so expensive, you know, often costing north of $1 billion or even $2 billion, it's really very important for the owners to figure out not only how to maximize on the people that do walk through the turnstiles, but also just to figure out what they can do to make sure that those people want to come back.
It seems appropriate that all of this is happening in the heart of Silicon Valley.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot that you can focus on when you're talking about the connectivity, but there's all kinds of other interesting bells and whistles inside and around Levi's Stadium. They have electric car charging stations. There's vegetation on the roof of the suites designed to regulate the climate inside. There are solar panels on the roof and a ton of other little bells and whistles. It's not an accident that a stadium like this was built right in the heart of Silicon Valley.
Well, it's great that we had the chance to have connectivity with you. Max Willens, writing for International Business Times. And check out his article online, Why the Super Bowl 2016 App and High-Tech Levi's Stadium Are the Future for the NFL Fans. Thanks so much for joining us, Max.
Thank you.
Oh, and by the way, there is a game. Yeah, that's right. The Denver Broncos and the Carolina Panthers on Sunday. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
They're very beautiful, talented, and fiercely competitive. Many of this year's Academy Award nominees in the categories of Best Actress in a Leading Role and Supporting Role are young, prolific thespians who are making their way into the Hollywood establishment. More now from VOA's Penelope Palou.
Step over this way, please. Get out of the line. Next. Passport, please. Welcome to the United States, ma'am.
Saoirse Ronan belongs to a new generation of actresses getting Hollywood's attention. The 21-year-old received an Oscar nomination for Best Actress for her delicate, complex, and understated performance as Eilish, an Irish single woman who immigrates to Brooklyn in the 1950s, hoping for a better life.
Would you dance with me?
I'm not Irish.
So what were you doing at an Irish dance?
I really like Irish girls.
At 21 years old, Saoirse has made more than 20 movies. She was first nominated for an Academy Award at age 13 for her role in the period drama Atonement. But Saoirse is facing stiff competition at the Oscars from another young peer.
Jack, listen to me. This is
our chance.
Brie Larson offers a riveting performance as an abducted woman imprisoned in a small shack with her 5-year-old son, a product of rape by her abductor.
Did you ever think you would be free?
I hoped.
Larson is considered by many the Oscar frontrunner for Best Actress. And like Ronan, Larson at 26 comes with a film portfolio of more than 20 feature movies. Alicia Vikander is just a year older than Larson. Her career took off with her portrayal of enigmatic Ava, a humanoid robot in the film Ex Machina. She has a Best Supporting Actress nomination for her portrayal of 1930s artist Gerda Viner in The Danish Girl. She plays the wife of a pioneering transgender man, starring alongside Oscar-winning Eddie Redmayne. And she is becoming one of the most sought-after young actresses today.
I need my husband.
I need to hold my husband.
Vikander's main opponent is Rooney Mara. She is an already known entity in Hollywood. She's nominated for an Oscar in a supporting role in the lesbian romantic drama Carol, for playing innocent and unassuming Therese opposite her older love interest, Carol, played by Cate Blanchett.
What a strange girl you are.
Why?
Mara received her first Oscar nomination in 2012 for her cutting-edge interpretation of a young and homeless computer hacker in the American version of the Scandinavian thriller The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Special mention should be given to another 20-something, Jennifer Lawrence, an Oscar nominee in the category of lead actress, for her title role in the romantic dramedy, Joy. At 25 years old, Lawrence has acted in well over 20 films, including the blockbuster Hunger Games series. She has already won an Oscar and is, according to Forbes magazine, the highest paid actress in Hollywood today. Lawrence's meteoric rise signals her young peers that edgy, intelligent roles, unassuming talent, and hard work are valued by wide audiences and critics alike. Welcome. Penelope Poulou, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. And we're also out there on social media, on Twitter at @VOA_IE. We celebrate our engineer Zeynep Abdel-Rahman and our director Tracy Carter. Thanks so much for being with us. Most of all, we appreciate you joining us today. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a rising tide of religious persecution emerging worldwide, and it disproportionately threatens religious minority groups. This threat touches Christians in the Middle East, Yazidis in Iraq, Baha'is in Iran, Hindus in Pakistan and Bangladesh, Muslims in India, or Sunni Muslims in Shia areas, or vice versa. The threat, said Special Advisor for Religious Minorities in the Near East and South and Central Asia, Knox Thames, is clear and present. Terrorists and non-state actors such as ISIL, the Nusra Front, and Al-Qaeda are some of the worst persecutors of religious minorities. But individual attackers have also perpetrated acts of violence against religious minorities. And unfortunately, in far too many places, governments continue to limit the exercise of religious freedoms. Protecting and promoting the universal right to freedom of religion is central to American foreign policy. Not only is it the right thing to do, said Special Advisor Knox, it is a smart thing to do as it plays a major role in contributing to more stable, progressive, and dynamic societies. Wherever people face religious persecution, the United States is at work finding ways to help. For example, the U.S. pressures governments to enact reforms so that religious minorities are able to freely practice their faith. Militarily, through airstrikes, the U.S. is providing protection for minority religions to remain in their ancestral homeland. The U.S. continues to provide humanitarian assistance to Syrians and Iraqis, including refugees and displaced populations, and supports resettlement for those who cannot safely return home. The U.S. is encouraging countries in the Middle East to support through education, respect for human rights, and religious freedom. Governments in the region are also being urged to take steps to protect religious minorities during holy days and religious gatherings. The United States said President Barack Obama will continue to work with a broad coalition against those who have subjected religious minorities to unspeakable violence and persecution. All people deserve the fundamental dignity of practicing their faith free from fear, intimidation, and violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.